For those of us who haven't met, my name is Joe Barnt, and we're going to do some talking this week about South Africa. I can't help but begin, though, but by picking up on Elmer's words of God being crazy, and I wish I had the book with me, and maybe I or John or somebody will to read this poem completely in the next sometime this week, but. There's a poem by James Carroll in his book Elements of Hope in which he says that that by our standards God is slightly crazy. And then he goes on to say, here is hope that by God's standards we're slightly crazy too. And says that here's what you and I and God have in common, common craziness. Theologians call it grace. And it's an excellent poem, and I'm almost ashamed to just read that portion of it because it doesn't even begin to carry some of its depths, and I hope somebody or I will bring that poem so that we can read it sometime this week. I'd like to just begin by saying a couple of things about a basic purpose of talking about South Africa and why I'm talking about South Africa, not being South African. With a Lutheran, the help of a Lutheran World Federation funding and sending, I spent the last half of last year, about 4.5 months, in South Africa and Namibia and a little touch into Rhodesia, which is was hardly anything, but a good block of time in South Africa and Namibia. From June through November, during which time, for those of you who remember have any sense of following the history of what's happening in South Africa these days, that was a time in which there was a lot of important things happening, not the least of which was the tragic murder of Stephen Biko, which I had a chance to also go to his funeral, and I'd like to share a little bit about that. But it was during that time when they were observing the first anniversary of the Soweto uprisings, and then at the very end of my time leaving after the Biko funeral was the latest act of repression, when almost anybody who had any organizational activity in opposition to apartheid was arrested, put under the ban, which is like house arrest, and so that the lid was put on the total squeeze on South Africa again. That's the time I was there. I'd like to quickly say also the purpose for my going, because I think it needs to be hooked up back where we are. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I work in New York City, the South Bronx, but I also work in many, many other parts of the country. My primary work in the church, as well as in the cities of our country, is in the combating of racism in church and society. And so my major concern is not South Africa. My major concern is racism in the United States. And that's where I spend my full time. I guess I don't know much about anything, but that which I know the most about is racism in our country, including trying to constantly be in touch with my own. So my purpose for going to South Africa was first of all to see the connections, to learn not simply how we can help that struggle there and how we should be interested in that struggle there and how we can be in solidarity with brothers and sisters who are working for justice and freedom there, but the reverse of that. I'm interested primarily in the effects and the impact of that struggle in South Africa on our struggle in the United States to become more just, and especially more just in the racial relationships in our country. So that'll be, I hope that'll come out in our talks, that to me is the most important issue. And along with that is the second parallel issue to that, is, and for some of you who heard me and were participating in discussions last week with me, know that I have a deep conviction that the mission of the church is being reversed, and that if we understand the mission of the International Church of Jesus Christ, it's a little different than the first part of this century when it was for us to be carrying the gospel to the rest of the world, that it's being reversed, and the people in places like South Africa and other places in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, our brothers and sisters in Christ are making discoveries about the nature of the gospel and the mission of the church today, and have that to teach to us. We have and Walt Bowman's beautiful phrase about who wants to be a missionary to deepest, darkest Ohio, that we are a people who are in deep trouble, who are manufacturing the weapons to destroy the world, who are having a difficult time facing the crisis of using and consuming the world at the expense and death of many other people. And we need to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ in the midst of that. And that the people of the third world, our Christian brothers and sisters of the third world, in the situations where they are learning about the meaning of the gospel of Jesus Christ in our day in a way that we need to hear. And so that was another reason for my being in South Africa, another opportunity to be hearing what our brothers and sisters in Christ have to preach in the name of Jesus Christ to us. Well, that's enough by words of introduction. I guess I only say one other thing, and that is that I'm not an expert on South Africa. I am an expert on my own trip to South Africa. I don't claim to be an expert on South Africa beyond that. There may be people here who know at least as much and perhaps much more about that struggle than I do. I invite all of you today and in future sessions this week on South Africa to not only share what you know and your analysis of that, but to disagree with me and with each other and to struggle together to come to a meaning of the gospel of Jesus Christ in our day, and not just to make accept anything I say as the final word.
I was wondering if you were in some sort of danger when you were down. Did they know your view and what you're kind of up to?
I'll tell a little bit about that. In some sort of introductory kind of way of something of the current situation. I'd like to talk today mostly about the current situation as I learned about it in South Africa. Tomorrow morning I'd like to talk about our nation and Europe also and its relationship to that struggle in both helping it and hindering it. Then the following 2 days I'll be in the 10:30 slot rather than the 9:15 slot, and I'd like to talk more about the church and its participation and resistance in South Africa. And secondly, the meaning, directly talk about the meaning of that struggle for us here in the United States. And then in some afternoon slots, it'll be announced, I have some slides, if anybody wants to see them, on South Africa that I took, of Soweto and other places. And then towards the end of the week, I have a film strip on the issue of banking in South Africa, our banks in South Africa. So there's going to be plenty of a hodgepodge. I'm going to try and do it in a way that that you don't have to come to every session if you don't want to, in order to that each session will be a whole in itself for people who can't come to all of them. I just want that by make it clear to say that there, that for my presentations to the community, it's going to be an South Africa week. I have a map here. I'll keep it up all week for those of you who need to be re-familiarized with a map of Africa to know that South Africa is this large country in the very tip. Namibia, which I'll also be talking about, which used to be named by the known by the colonial name of Southwest Africa, is this right here, and that area is surrounded by a whole area of other nations struggling against or having just won in their struggle against white domination. I'll be talking more about that. You'll be able to read. I'll try and refer to the map, and you can re-familiarize yourself by coming up and looking at it yourself if you wish.
Joel, can you tell me how to spell that word you're saying that started with N?
Namibia. Namibia. It's the name of the revolutionary name for Southwest Africa. It's recognized internationally now as the new name for that country. And it's named after the Namib Desert, Namib, right along the Atlantic coast here, and is one of the oldest deserts in the world. I don't want to fill you with a lot of facts and figures, but most of you probably already have this in your head, and I'll just be recalling it for you, that the population of South Africa is approximately 25 million people, 25, 26 million people, somewhere in there. Only 5 or 6 million of those are white. Only 5 or 6 million of those are white. And they were predominantly the Dutch people who began in the 18th century to colonize that area, and then later the English who came in, and so that they are predominant. They're about half of those 6 million are Afrikaners, as they call themselves, the people of the Dutch tradition, or they're also known as Boers, B-O-E-R-S. The Afrikaners are about half of them, and about half are of the English speaking. So there are two languages of the white people in South Africa. One is Afrikaans, which is a derivative of Dutch. If you spoke Dutch, you'd be able to understand at least some of the Afrikaans language. And the other is English. And it's a bilingual white nation. Now the other 20 million are black. I think it's about 15 million, 15 or 16 million of them are of the African, black African, of the various tribes that were there when the Dutch people came or who have migrated there since. And then the remaining are divided between those who are called colored, that is, those who are whose blood has been created by a mixture of the African and white during the time. The African people won't admit to having participated in that, so they blame it on passing sailors. And Asian, predominantly Indian and Malay, who were brought there as indentured servants, a semi-kind of slavery, as some of our forebears were brought here from Europe, and the Indian people who were brought to Trinidad and other parts of the Caribbean areas also happened here. So there's that mixture, but the predominant vast number of the people of South Africa are black South Africans, or South Africans, and then the vast majority are non-white. Now, it's important to remember that, as you well know, because the government, the power, the benefits, the richness, everything that exists in South Africa exists for the white people. The black people of South Africa have absolutely no control over who they are, what they want to be, what their government should be. They have no votes, they have no citizenship rights, they have no ownership of property, and they exist only in terms of the needs of the white people. Totally. And I'll come to more about that later. It's important to remember that. It's important also to remember about the goals of that white government. I'll be coming back to them over and over again today in terms of what the white government lives by many, many laws and self-deceptions. They really believe themselves to be a kind, beneficial Christian people. And they do what they do in the name of a Christian religion, what they call a Christian religion. And have a deep sense of their fulfilling God's will as a chosen people. It's really important to remember that. They also are going through a process, and it's really important if you listen to the news about what's happening in South Africa, what their goals are, what the white government's goals are, is to, and I'll explain what this means, and this is a generalization, so that we can understand it in our terms, to put all of the South African black people onto reservations. They call them homelands. They have created 9 specific homelands, not too far different from our reservation policy with the Native Americans. They are declaring that every black South African belongs to one of those homelands. They are intending to make all of those 9 homelands independent. Whether they want to be or not, they've already done it with 2 of them, the Transkei and Botswana. And then by fiat declare all of the 20 or most of the 20 million black South Africans as non-citizens of South Africa, and then say, see, we are a democracy in which the majority of the people determine what happens in this country. To make South Africa into a white nation by creating other small, tiny, poor nations that the black people will be citizens of. And therefore, they will no longer be subject to the criticism of being a minority government. Now, that's really important. That is the goal and the hope of the South African people. They hope to put 83% of the population onto 13% of the land, And as we did with our reservations here, to choose the worst of the land for those reservations, for those homelands, and to carve out where there's good things in those homelands, like rich farmland or minerals, to call them white spots and to take them and to declare them as not part of the homeland. We'll come more to more of that, but that's part of the goals of what is being done in South Africa in the very blatant, open kind of way, and yet in some strange kind of way that the white people do not see as wrong, see themselves as being, working to be a just people. It's very, very difficult to understand. Secondly, that's South Africa. I want to also quickly say something about Namibia as an introductory word also. Southwest Africa, or Namibia, was a colony that was first started by the Germans. It was a German colony. And in the last part of the 19th century, the Germans got their early practice of becoming of how to create concentration camps and extermination policies by exterminating the vast numbers of the people of the different tribes of Southwest Africa, especially the Herero people. Approximately 75 to 80% of the people were exterminated by the Germans when it was a colony. I'll give you the bad news first. We'll come to the good news later. The man who was the second administrator general of Southwest Africa and who developed the extermination practices' name was Heinrich Goring. His son Herman grew up there, learned about it, and went back home to be the butcher under Hitler, Herman Goring. So the connections are incredible, just incredible. 1917, after the Second World War, the League of Nations took Southwest Africa from Germany, as they did all of Germany's colonies, gave it to South Africa to administer, not to be a part of South Africa, but to administer. From that time until 1966, just 12 years ago, South Africa was the administrator of Southwest Africa. During that time, South Africa tried her best to get to annex and make that part of her country. It never worked. Finally, after long, long, hard struggle, in 1966, the United Nations took away the mandate from South Africa to be the administrator of Southwest Africa as a colony. South Africa used all of her same practices of apartheid, of separation, and of oppression of black people, and applied them also to Namibia in exactly the same way. In 1966, the United Nations, and this is the beginning of some very good news for Southwest Africa, Namibia, took away the mandate, said South Africa may no longer be the administrator of Southwest Africa, of Namibia, and must give it up so that elections and a free government may be developed there. Well, South Africa said no, and has since, in the last 12 years, been violating the mandates of the United Nations and refusing to give it up. Maybe, if you've been reading your papers recently, maybe a solution to that is on the horizon. It may be that an agreement has been reached between the South Africa and the Forces for Liberation of Namibia so that within the next couple of months they will have arrived at a plan administered by the United Nations to have free elections in Namibia. So good news may be on the horizon in relationship to that. So I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along too. It's just a little framework for some of this. Now, getting back to your question and something about my trip, which, I, as I said, it's the only thing I'm really an expert on. It's nice to be able to celebrate some of the really good things our church is doing. The Lutheran World Federation has done enough good things in helping South African black people to protest the oppression there, so many good things that a Lutheran cannot get a visa to go into South Africa anymore, or a Lutheran pastor at least. So if you want a symbol that the church is doing something really good, we can't get visas, at least a representative of the Lutheran World Federation or representative of Lutheran churches throughout the world has a very hard time getting a visa to go in there. So I felt a little James Bondish about this, but the only way to get in was to practice some deception with the help of some people from the churches there and here. I applied for a visa as a lay person. I said that I was a self-employed freelance consultant in personnel relations. Which is almost true. I'm a freelance consultant in race relations. That's pretty close. I do that a lot with factories doing desegregation. So anyway, said I'd never written a thing in my life. They're really worried about writers coming into South Africa. And they ask 5 questions on the visa form. Are you a writer? What have you written? Are you going to write about South Africa? For whom are you going to write it? And then the most ridiculous of all questions, what are you going to write? So I said no to all of them. Had a friend of mine who runs a travel agency in mid-New Jersey. I didn't want them seeing a visa application coming out of the South Bronx, because I'm sure they're not used to people from South Bronx being able to afford to go to South Africa. So I had a friend of mine who runs a travel agency in mid-state New Jersey apply for my visa for me, and I got my visa. Surprise! I was really surprised, because if I were South African government, didn't want writers into my country, I would keep a catalog of existing books, and for every visa I'd check under that name, if they'd done that, they'd have found some books on racism by me, and they would have not allowed me in. But their government and their Bureau of State Security, their FBI, if you will, called BOSS, Bureau of State Security, is ruthless, but not very efficient. It's pretty easy to slip by them, especially if you're white. Let me say that now. It's a really interesting thing, and it's really just sort of an exaggeration of our racism also. In South Africa, in such an exaggerated way that it's incredible, if you are white, you are right. Period. Well, that's to a great degree true in race relations in the United States, but it's really true there. If you're white, you're right. It's the pathology, the sickness of racism in South Africa is so deep that it's impossible for them to learn to mistrust somebody white. I mean, it's sort of like a bad check writer, you know, that who just can't stop writing bad checks. They cannot stop trusting white people. Sometimes they have to arrest and convict and put in jail white people, but the things you have to do in order to have that happen, and then you could have 4 people in a row that they had to convict and put in jail, and they still would find it impossible to even mistrust the 5th. That's incredible. So once you're, it's pretty easy to get by with things when you're white. At any rate, but I didn't know that, not feeling very afraid for having told all those dirty lies, I figured I had to make myself look the part. So in London, on my way to South Africa, in my tiny little hotel room, I went through the process of, and I had very long hair at the time, and I got a crew cut, and I shaved off my beard, and had a visa picture taken of the same way about a year earlier. I looked like a member of BOSS. I looked so straight, and I looked tough. And then I flew to Dar es Salaam, where the Lutheran World Federation was holding its assembly at the time in June of last year. And there I got to talk to, for the first time, the people who had invited me to South Africa, because their mail is constantly checked, and it's impossible to send things through the mail to them. And so we were not able to communicate at all about my coming, except through messages that verbally communicated when we accidentally knew of somebody going in each other's direction. So I had a chance to sit down 3 days before I got into South Africa to talk with the people who had invited me. And they said to me, not then, but when I got into South Africa the next week, I met them then inside South Africa, and they said, "We recognize that you had to use deception to get into our country, but now we invite you to do what we try to do, and that is not to permit the government to dictate who we will be. And that is, be yourself. Because if you start hiding and deceiving, then you're giving the government more power than it has to have. So we invite you to do what we do and not let the government have that power over you. Well, that scared the hell out of me. But one of the things that gave me strength in that is that they're practicing that. They risk their lives every day. And all I was risking was being kicked out of the country. So I that gave me a lot of courage. And so that it took me a while to learn to do that. You know, I'm sort of just a little paranoid to begin with. And it's good reason to be paranoid there. But after a while, I began to do some preaching and a lot of visiting in the Soweto and other black townships. And chances is I'll tell you about a few examples of to meet with some of the people in the struggle, a lot of high school kids, and it is high school and university age people who are leading the revolution in South Africa, and spent a lot of exciting time with them. I spent about a month in Johannesburg, and tomorrow I'll try and find, if I remember to bring it with me, a map of all of South Africa. And time wandering all around South Africa and some of the homelands and down into Cape Town, where they're just the shanty towns are being bulldozed left and right by the thousands, and then the people transported in trains and buses back to the homelands to make them to become citizens, and the people just keep coming back. It's very much an uncontrollable system for the South Africans there. The time is coming when they'll have to face the fact that they cannot do what they want to do. Let me take a few moments to say something about one of the ways I learn to know something and to share about something is to compare with something we know. So I'd like to say how I found South Africa to be different from us. And I'd like to share some ways in which I found South Africa to be very similar to us. And then a couple of words about the present situation, and then I'll stop for the day and we can have some discussion. There are three ways in which I found the system, and by the way, I should have written it up on the board, a couple of these words. The name of the system of segregation in South Africa, if you've never heard it before, is apartheid. You can hear the word apart in it. And it's a Dutch word which means segregation, living apart, separation. Apartheid, A-P-A-R-T-H-E-I-D, apartheid. That's the system of apartheid. That is the name that is used over and over again. And it's the official name of a government of segregation. Now, the differences I found from our own country different from our own country is that in terms of race relations, the numbers, and if you can picture this, are totally reversed. That in our country, and we should remember this, about one of the reasons we're so easily able to practice democracy is that we can outvote anybody that ain't white. The numbers are reversed. And in South Africa, if you're white, you are a distinct small minority, one of 13%. And if somebody said, you ought to have one man, one vote, you would have to worry about being outvoted. So there's a tremendous difference about talking about and looking at racial equality there and here. And so the numbers are very different. And in spite of the fact that we, as white people, in our racism, have tremendous fear in the United States. I remember the days in the 60s when we expressed our fear so much about them coming to get us, and what we were really expressing was our guilt about what we'd done to them. But I remember times like, for example, when Huey Newton was convicted in Oakland, where I had a parish in Oakland, is that our church was immediately surrounded by the state police. It had been planned ahead of time because they were sure that the people inside of our church were going to plan an invasion of the white community because Huey Newton was convicted. And they immediately closed three high schools in the white community and sent them all home because they thought there were going to be riots. There weren't any such thing, but it's the kind of fear that we have in us. You can imagine how much more the fear and guilt of the people in South Africa who live and can total control of that country, and yet the distinct minority, and have that sense of constantly being surrounded. They are fearful people. So that's, in many ways, very different from ours. The numbers reversed. Secondly, the system still says there, as opposed to ours, that racism is legally required. The system requires racism by law. Now, we are not many years from that being true in our country. And I'm not just talking about Juneteenth. I'm not just talking about the emancipation of last century. I mean 1965. A little over 10 years ago, racism was still required in many ways of our country. It was not illegal in many ways to be racist in our country. Now we have to find other ways to do it. When we want to practice racism, we have to find other ways than legal ways to do it in our country. A little over 10 years ago, racism was still required in many ways of our country. It was not illegal in many ways to be racist in our country. Now we have to find other ways to do it. When we want to practice racism, we have to find other ways than legal ways to do it in our country. In South Africa, it is still not only legally possible, but required by a vast system of laws. And if you want to get arrested in South Africa, don't be racist. Then thirdly, another third major difference I found in South Africa from our country is that, this is a little difficult for me to explain, it has to do with the distinctions between race and class. In South Africa, race and class are identical. You cannot be white and go below a certain class living level or a certain job level. Race and class are coincidental. You cannot be black and go above a certain level. Certain kind of jobs you couldn't have in South Africa, and many, many kinds of jobs a black person can't have in South Africa. And those lines of race and class are coincidental. They're at the same level. In our country, while the majority of black people in our country and brown people and red people and yellow people are in the laboring class or in the poor class, there are many white people in that class also. And there are also many black people, brown people, red people, or some at least, in the upper classes. So race and class are not totally coincidental in our country. And it's kind of a shock for me to go into a country where they're totally coincidental. I wanted to live and experience what it's like to be in the lower classes in South Africa. You can do that in our country, and I think it's very important for all of us to know what that's like. It's illegal to do that in South Africa. Whenever I went into communities and stayed overnight in those communities or went into certain areas of different class, I did so at the risk of being arrested because it's illegal for a white person to do those things. And the same thing reversed. When a black person stayed overnight at places I was at, in upper class places or white person places, if the police came that night, everybody in that house would be arrested because a black person was there overnight. So there are many, many ways in which it's different. South Africa is different. Now, the reason I say that, because I want to share with you the many ways I found the similarities between South Africa and here. And as I said, I want to, some of you may find these words hard, and you're free to disagree with me. There are some areas which I found extremely important for me in order to understand South Africa. and that is the ways in which South Africa is similar to us. And that we can't say, South Africa, you are evil, and we are good, and you must start being like us. I found, you know, the experience of deja vu? I've been here before. You go through a situation, all of a sudden, this has happened to me before. Over and over and over again in South Africa, I went through experiences of deja vu. I have been here before. I've been to toilets that said, you know, not only divided between men and women, but black and white. And then they even go an exaggerated step further, and you may have six toilets. You know, black men, black women, white women, Indian men, Indian women. And it gets very complicated. Then you can have another set that's colored men and colored women, because their system of apartheid not only divides white from black, but divides those three kinds of black from each other to keep them opposed and competing with each other. Same way as in many ways in our country, black and Puerto Rican are constantly, the poor are pitted against each other. In my community in the South Bronx, there's hostility between the black and the Puerto Rican. And that's engendered by the system that makes them compete with each other for survival. And they don't, instead of finding the ways in which they have in common their struggle for justice, they end up eating each other up. The hostility that they cannot take out on a system ends up being taken out against each other. Any good warden knows that the way to run a prison, if he's not a human being, is to keep the prisoners fighting each other so that they can't begin to join together for each other to struggle for freedom, and that they won't take their hostility out on the guards. And our system and the African system knows a lot about doing that. Deja vu when looking at the systems of segregation, which, you know, the black restaurant, the no blacks allowed in our restaurants, bus stations, and toilets are pretty much eliminated in our country, but we still have the division. We still have segregated ghettos, the white ghetto and the black ghetto. When South Africans come to visit me in New York, they said, "Oh, I see, your Soweto is inside the city." And theirs is outside. So the segregation still exists in our housing and in much of our schools. The deja vu in when I went to Steve Biko and the funerals of other black people and white people killed while I was there because of the struggle just reminded me over and over again of the funerals I was attended of so many of my friends in the 60s in the civil rights movement. Over and over again, and I came to the conclusion, and I hope you'll struggle with me at this, that South Africa is an exaggerated caricature of us. It's, you know, in one sense, just much, much worse than us, but what it's worse at is the things that we also do, an exaggerated caricature of us, if you will, a distorted image, you know, like you go into the fun house and see the mirrors that make you look all those funny shapes. I'm a distorted mirror, but a mirror nevertheless of us. Or even to say it stronger, that maybe South Africa is a microcosm of the whole world. Because if I describe South Africa in terms of population and poverty and riches and the divisions and color, it really could be taken as a description of the whole world, in which the white people throughout the world are a vast minority, a very small minority, and hold most of the property, and a struggle of the non-white people throughout the world to gain control of their rights and of their resources and of their own bodies again. Well, one other way, a third way in which I found similarities, not only in terms of it being an exaggerated caricature of us and a microcosm of the whole world, where it was just amazing, and if anyone has wishes to see the slides I'll show tomorrow afternoon, be able to see this in picture, the parallels in South African history to ours. Robert Kennedy, when he made a speech in 1965 at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, started out his speech with a paragraph, and I don't have the words of it with me. I heard it on a record, and I have some friends of mine from South Africa who are promising to send me the words from the record. The first two paragraphs, or few moments of his speech, he said, I am here tonight because of my love and respect for a nation. And then he went on, and I'll come back to that sentence, went on and listed a history and characteristics of a nation, and that the students at the and professors at the University of Cape Town that were listening thought he was talking about South Africa. And he said, I'm here tonight because of my love and respect for a nation that was first settled by the Dutch, that fought for its freedom from the English, that has had difficulty with the natives on its shores ever since it first arrived, that still has a hostile and separated, segregated relationship to the black people within its borders, that has a frontier history of expansion, that found gold at the end of that frontier expansion. It went on and on and on, and there, and all the South Africans saying, just, well, what's his point? He's talking about us. And then when he got through, he said, of course I'm talking about the United States of America. The parallels of colonial times. If you see my slides, you'll see their Conestoga wagons, their frontier expansion, their reasons for frontier expansion, their feeling of crowdedness in this colonial area because somebody moved within 2 miles of them and wanting to go on, their expansion into a country, their capturing and slaughtering and wars with the natives as they expanded. Even to the pulling of their wagons into a circle of as a means of defense. And I was taught by some people to say that it, and they called that pulling their wagons into a circle, crawling into a lager in the Afrikaans language. And they said, if you want to understand the mentality of the Afrikaans people, you have to understand that they're still crawling into lagers whenever they're threatened. And so they pull themselves into a circle, and they encamp themselves so that somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. And remember how we did that? Neither the Indians did it or we did it. And that's the way it still is today with the people of South Africa. Well, the history of South Africa, even to the point of Johannesburg existing today, the only reason Johannesburg exists today is that the end of the frontier expansion was gold. And one of the major reasons that not only Johannesburg exists, but that South Africa's history is the way it is today, is because of gold and diamonds. And as I'll talk about a little bit tomorrow, one of the major reasons we have such a difficult time knowing whose side we're on is because of our investment in that gold also. And I want to talk about that some more tomorrow. I'd want to stop for discussion. I will pick up a little bit tomorrow and talk a little bit more about the current situation in the last 3 years, 1976, the beginning of the current period of rebellion. Remember the Soweto uprisings, 2,000 people killed by the armies and the police of South Africa within a month's time. Last year, while I was there, the repression, the sealing of the lid again, putting the lid back on and turning the screws down because the repression was, and because of the uprising and rebellion was getting too strong, and now coming into a time of renewed suffering and resistance in the underground. And because of South Africa having done that in the last 3 years, almost ensuring, I think, that the future for South Africa, the near future for South Africa, will be a very, very frighteningly violent and bloody one. There may be in the minds of, as Elmer was talking about this morning, about some ways we feel the kingdom now, Simul, at the same time as the South African people are convinced, know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the future is theirs, that this cannot go on, that it's impossible. And so that on the other side of that mountain, in the minds of the vast majority of black South Africans, is a country of freedom. But none of them doubts that the climb over that mountain is going to be filled with incredible violence. Many people afraid that it will be reminiscent of Hitler and extermination again. Karen.
I wanted to know something to say about one of the phenomena that I heard people talk about very, very little, maybe one a couple of years ago, actually, it was just the week before the Soweto riots, which was interesting. We had some people here from South Africa. one of them was a businessman that operated a factory. And I think he was somewhat sympathetic to the cause. Did he talk about the problem of race, of discrimination between the black tribes? And you touched on that a little bit, in that you know, part of the system is to pit people against each other. But it seems to me that's another very deep problem that the blacks have in dealing with each other. Do you know something about that? There's some very ancient animosities and distinctions between black tribes that, well, this guy said, for example, that the blacks in his factory would not tolerate that another black tribe would have certain jobs and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I would be too long and complicated and need a better expert than me to trace some of the history of the development of tribal animosity and hostility. A lot of it came in the same way that it happened amongst Native Americans in this country, that when we drove the natives of one tribe into the land of another, we created and even exaggerated the hostility between those. And the results of that were just incredible. And there's a long history of how tribal, I don't want to also leave out that the long histories before white people ever existed were included, as in every country and every nation and every continent, a long history of warfare and competition between the black African tribes. That's been going on for centuries, as it has between our tribes. Our white tribes, like Norwegians and Swedes, and the history of wars between them. The thing is that the deliberate practice of South Africa to lift that up and to make that happen more, to keep them divided between each other, to make sure that those tribes do not get along with each other, to keep them even segregated from each other in the black townships. Happens over and over again. So that, yes, that's true, and it's a weapon of white South Africa against the black people.
Are there Lutheran churches in South Africa and Namibia?
Yes, Namibia is, and one of the reasons, as many of you have through your churches learned a lot about Namibia in the last few years, and one of the reasons is that the vast majority of Namibia is Lutheran, and when we get to talking. On Wednesday in my session, I want to talk mostly about the churches and their participation in resistance. And then there are not a majority at all in South Africa, but a great number of Lutherans, black and white, in South Africa also. With some marvelous exceptions, the white South African Lutherans are as loyal to the apartheid government as is the Dutch Reformed Church. It's frightening, but with some marvelous exceptions. I am just incredibly excited about the exceptions. And at the same time, in the black churches, especially of Namibia and also South Africa, the marvelous participation in resistance and witnessing to justice and willingness to suffer is really marvelous also. I'd like to talk about both of those on Wednesday.
Some of the differences that you mentioned will begin to become commonalities because, for example, in Greater Los Angeles by 1980, Anglos will be a minority, and the ethnic majority will be Hispanic. And we Lutherans, I think, have one Hispanic ordained pastor in the area, for example. But learning to understand from your kind of experience how to work positively in these kinds of changes is so important that I hope that as the week goes on some comparisons of that kind will be drawn too.
I'd like to put some predictions or some I've lost the word. The coming attractions, which may frustrate some of you who are leaving this week, that my next week's lectures will all be on combating racism in the United States. But we can do some more of that, I hope, here.
there must be some white, not particularly Lutherans, but of all creeds who are against apartheid. I mean, it is not a unanimous thing, by all means.
No, that's right. That's very true, and it takes on all shades. Generally speaking, people talk about the English-speaking white people, half of the population, as being against apartheid. That's not really that easily divided, and oftentimes it's very comparable to our experiences here. It's a lot of that opposition to apartheid is wanting to keep the system of apartheid but treat them better. It's sort of making apartheid more humane, and that's a very deceptive kind of thing, as I'm sure you can hear. And but a lot of white people are working very hard for the improving of conditions for black people, but are not working for the elimination of apartheid. Then there is another group of people who are very opposed to apartheid. Some of them who are putting their lives on the line, along with same as black people are. It's a very hard and important struggle for white people to be working with white people, as it is also here, to help them to come to the point where they're willing to join the struggle against apartheid for white people's sake and not just for black people's sake.
In the scientific circles, we are seeing quite a number of people leaving South Africa. What extent is that in?
I have some sense of the exodus from Rhodesia that has taken place. Not too much about South Africa, except to say that once again the division between English and Afrikaans comes very strong. The Afrikaner people have a deep sense of being African. They have got no place else to go. They haven't got home someplace. They ain't going nowhere, and unfortunately, and black people over and over again told me this, and that they consider the white Afrikaans people to be Africans, and they wish they would use their loyalty to African soil to build a new South Africa rather than to exclude other Africans. And that they said that they are not opposed to South Africans, they're opposed to un-African racism. The English-speaking people, though, have a sense, as they do throughout the world, of saying, well, we can go to Australia, or we can go here, we can go there. So the people who would be leaving would be the English more than the Afrikaner. I invite you to probe this deeper tomorrow. In the afternoon sessions, when we're showing films and slides, if you take part in those, I'll also bring resources that if you'd like to read some more things also, and we have a chance to chat about what some things you can read.